Middle East prospects next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation about politics and culture in the Middle East. My guest is John Vall, professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and president of the Middle East Studies Association of North America.
Great persons do not create the opportunities in terms of the very broad picture. Great persons are the people who can take advantage of the opportunity. I think that the opportunity for this handshake on the White House lawn existed already a couple years ago.
Historian and Middle East specialist John Vall. He'll be back in just a moment to talk about culture and politics in the Middle East. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Last fall, after decades of military confrontation and territorial disputes, two principal combatants in the Middle East seemed to be on the road to peace. The Israeli Prime Minister and the leader of the Palestinian Liberation Organization exchanged a handshake on the White House lawn as the world looked on with a mixture of amazement, caution, and hope. Then, a couple of months ago, came the unexpected and murderous attack of an Israeli settler on Muslims at prayer. As the old hostilities rekindled, there simultaneously issued calls to arms and entreaties for the peace talks to continue. In this country, one observer who watched all this with special interest was John Vall. He's a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and the president of the Middle East Studies Association of North America. When that group recently held national meetings that included a stop at the National Humanities Center, I asked John Vall to talk about how people in this country might improve their understanding of the Middle East, its troubled past, and its uncertain future. He's here now to talk not so much about the headlines as the history that created them and led to moments such as that memorable photograph of Rabin and Arafat on the White House lawn. John Vall's books include The Contemporary Islamic Revival and, more recently, Islam, Continuity and Change in the Modern World. In 1991, he received from Husni Mubarak of Egypt a presidential medal in recognition of his scholarship. Here is John Vall.
We've been living in a world that is just filled with grand changes, but this is one that I think is even more dramatic than almost anything else. The battle between the PLO and Israel is older than the Berlin Wall. The division of Palestine is in many ways older than the division of Germany. So you've got a very kind of dramatic thing that has taken place. But it has taken place in the context of dramatic changes within the Middle East itself. This was probably for Yasser Arafat and for Yitzhak Rabin and the Israeli government the last opportunity, give or take 6 months or a year, because of certain kinds of dynamics that were taking place. The Palestine Liberation Organization used to be virtually the whole kettle of fish in terms of talking to the Palestinians. But within the last 2 or 3 years, you have the emergence of a significant alternative in the Islamic movements, particularly Hamas.
All right, now let's see if we can break down some of the threads, some of the contributing factors here. Should we call them cultural? Should we call them economic? Should we call them political? How do they move in and out of one another there?
You've got power politics, people who are in power who need to stay in power or be replaced. You've got economics. You have growing numbers of settlers, for example, in terms of demographics and politics. Up until the breakdown of the Soviet Union, the Arabs could think time was on our side. We will outnumber the Jews in Israel.
Right.
With the breakdown of the Soviet Union and the immigration of significant numbers of Jews, time is now on the side of the Israeli Jewish population in filling up the territory.
Now, is this something that the Palestinians looked at and said, look, we don't necessarily want to make peace, but we've got to do it? Was this the logic of necessity or desire at work?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that people are saying, we don't want to make peace, but rather what you have is, if you look at the West Bank, you've got a significant number of settlements of Jewish Israelis who are there. That number has pretty much gone past 100,000 now. Many more settlers than that, and it's an irreversible process. The idea of having an independent or an autonomous or a self-governing Palestinian political unit, if you have more than, say, 150,000 Israeli Jews in the West Bank, that's not a possibility. Do you imagine that sort of Israeli entity, Palestinian entity? So you've got that kind of dynamic. You have the economic dynamic as well, that at the moment, Israel is trying to be more integrated into the surrounding region. You have the development of water, the development of agricultural resources, and any kind of rational development that would provide strength to the economy of Jordan or to Israel or to Syria requires some kind of agreement.
Let's pause on some of the contributing factors again, John Vall. You specialize in Islamic fundamentalism. Talk to me about the religious dimension of what happened in the Middle East recently.
In terms of the peace process, the religious dimension is purely political of who can speak for what group.
So we're not talking about theology when we talk of religion. We're talking of real social pressures.
That's right. That you have the Palestine Liberation Organization came into existence as a formal organization in the late 1960s because the Arab states were unable to make any kind of progress toward creating a Palestinian state. Uh-huh. The PLO has now had more than 20 years, and the general Palestinian population was beginning to say the same thing about the PLO that the PLO founders, Yasser Arafat, had said about people like the president of Egypt of the 1960s. You haven't made any accomplishments.
All right, but now my question goes to the issue of religion and fundamentalism.
But the people then who were saying in the late 80s, the people who were saying this were then the new emerging organizations that had popular appeal, and those are the Islamic fundamentalist organizations.
All right, now how did they talk to their constituency? Was it a religious, theological dialogue? Was it a social and a sort of practical dialogue going on there?
It's a moral and ethical dialogue, which means it's a mixture of sociology and theology. The society that you live in is corrupt, that's why it's weak. The society that you live in is wicked, that's why it's politically impotent.
Now, what you have just described there, as I understand it, a sort of mini summary of what the fundamentalists, the beef that they have with what we call the modern, that is to say, corrupt politics, inefficient systems when we're dealing with the practical needs of people, as much as religious questions.
But you see, they wouldn't separate it. They would not say this is a different thing from a religious question. Religion and politics are part of the same unit, and we see this in religious revivalist movements, fundamentalist movements, whether they're Hindu or Muslim or Christian, that the argument, for example, if you separate religion from politics, what you get is immoral politics.
Is that why the so-called fundamentalists of Islam or the Middle East are critical of life in the United States? We have separated our political and our religious life, and they look at us as weaklings because we've done that.
They look at us not necessarily as weaklings. The devil is very strong. They look at us rather as wicked and corrupt people.
All right, now let's step back from some of the immediate circumstances of the Middle East, John Vall. Talk to me again, put on your hat as a specialist in fundamentalism. How does that word travel across national boundaries? Really what we're doing is pursuing that same question. When we speak of fundamentalism in the United States and when we speak of fundamentalism in the Middle East, we got Jerry Falwell. And then we have got, who would be his analog in the Middle East? Or is that a fair question about Mr.
Falwell? It's a fair question. It's a fair question because you've got a real, you have analogs. Someone like Hassan Tarabi, who is the leader of the National Islamic Front in Sudan.
These are not household names in America.
These are not household names, but this is the spiritual guide and advisor to the existing government in Sudan, in the same way that the Ayatollah Khomeini was not president or prime minister of the government in Iran. He was the spiritual guide for the government. Fundamentalism, as a term, does not travel across cultural borders very well. You have two different dimensions to it. you have the dimension that secular, modern people use when they essentially sneer and say, this is just a fundamentalist, which means that this is somebody who is ignorant, who is backward, who is prejudiced and bigoted and so on. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the difficulties is that most analysts, most scholars are secularists and modernists, which means then that scholarship tends to be very negative on an emotional basis when they look at fundamentalists. The Ayatollah Khomeini, for example, was not a medieval reactionary.
Contrary to the press in this country.
Contrary to the press in most of the world. Uh-huh. The Ayatollah Khomeini was not conservative. He was revolutionary. He advocated the overthrow of the existing system, not preserving it. Even within Shiite Islam, the Ayatollah Khomeini represented an innovation in terms of theology, in terms of the perceptions of the world.
Well, how did he take this bum rap as this arch conservative, at least in the press in the West?
Because most people in the West think of the West as being the modern. And it becomes almost impossible for most Western modern people to think of somebody else as being modern but not Western.
Well, now here we're getting into the problem of who it is that sets up the ground rules for what we call geopolitics. If I set them up, then I can exclude you from my categories. If you set them up, then you're the one doing the excluding. How do we come to the point where we are at least mutual in our definitions?
I think that for starts, one of the things that we have to recognize is that there's a difference between explanation and advocacy. Huh. I find it very frustrating, for example, to have someone come to me and say, how on earth can the Iranians believe that kind of stuff that the Ayatollah Khomeini said? When I try and give them an answer to that question, how is it that they can believe it? They say, why are you advocating those kind of views?
But you don't see yourself doing that. See yourself, what, in professorial terms?
In pure relational terms, mm-hmm. I am not willing to say that the followers of the Ayatollah Khomeini were ignorant, backward, rural peasants who didn't know anything about the world, because they were not. The Iranian Revolution was the first revolution to really make effective use, for example, of the electronic media. It was a cassette revolution. Hmm. It was a revolution that depended on fiber optic long-distance telephone calls and so on. And these are not people who are revolutionary despite being modern. They are revolutionary because they are modern, but modern in a different way.
Well, that sounds like a roundabout way of being an apologist for what Americans nonetheless believe is barbaric behavior. So what if they took advantage of modern technology? They still are opposed to what we would call Western notions of liberal democracy and this grand term progress. Now, again, unpack it for me and tell me who's taking the bum rap.
There's no bum rap here. There is a set of obstacles to perceiving what's going on. Hmm. That the most modern, effective totalitarian regime in the world was the regime of Adolf Hitler. Now, one would not call Adolf Hitler a medieval monarch. One would call him a modern barbarian. Uh-huh. One would not see him as being medieval because he was evil. And one can disagree with what Islamic fundamentalists do in the same way that one can disagree with what Orthodox Christians do in Bosnia, or what Protestants do in Belfast, or what Catholics do in Belfast. One can disagree with that. One can say this is barbarous, this is hideous, this is evil, But that has nothing to do with whether or not the person is medieval or modern, conservative or radical. It has to do with the impact of what they're doing.
John Vaughn, let's step back from our conversation about the Middle East in terms of your own opinions and reflections. Your visit to the National Humanities Center is occasioned by the fact that your group, the MESA, it's called, the Middle Eastern Studies Association, is meeting here in the Research Triangle Park as we're doing this taping session. Talk to me for a few minutes about some of the concerns that you see on the minds of American scholars who look at the Middle East in historical, political, anthropological, literary terms. What is it that's on the forefront here of the interests of the members of your association?
I think in terms of research and in terms of teaching, one of the primary concerns of members of the Middle East Studies Association is the concern of American lack of understanding of radical changes and dramatic changes that are going on.
Well, now forgive me for being impertinent, mm-hmm. but boy, that is an old, old song that you're singing.
That's right. But it's also a very new song. Uh-huh. If, in fact, the United States, for example, wants to increase its exports to the Middle East, if its vision of the Middle East is that this is a country where the majority of the population are peasants plowing their fields with oxen, they're not going to sell anything any more than if they right. think that all of the people in Massachusetts are still wearing Puritan breech pants.
All right, so what do we do to correct these erroneous impressions? Talk about tall orders.
Well, I think one of the things that you do is you do have to have research. You do have to have effective teaching programs. You do have to have, probably most important of all, a significant addition of language instruction in our schools. I know that there are now some secondary schools around the country that are teaching Arabic in secondary school rather than waiting until college. Other countries that get along well mm-hmm. in terms of economics or in terms of the whole variety of things are countries that have language resources that we simply don't have.
All right, well, let me argue with you again, John. What do you say to the parents of American students who say, wait a minute, why should I finance the education of my kids to have them learn about these nominally barbaric societies, these societies that seem to be so intransigent and difficult when it comes to getting along in the modern world?
As a parent, if I had had an 18-year-old in 1968, I would have really been glad if the preceding generation had encouraged the understanding and learning of Vietnamese language so that policymakers and military planners would have known where they were sending my child off to war. Mm-hmm. I mean, putting it at the rock bottom, if we are going to have more desert shields and desert storms, we by damn better have a lot better intelligence, a lot better information than we've had.
You're really sticking your neck out here, John.
You know it.
you're making the case that, after all, in its own fashion, scholarship matters. That what these professional associations, such as yours, MESA, the Middle Eastern Studies Association, that what you all do matters in the real world.
That's right, indeed. I think that what we've got are business problems. We have social problems. We have military problems.
Which of the problems that in these vast and complex relationships that flow back and forth between the United States and the countries of the Middle East, which of them would you attack? Which of them do you think is the most serious, the most demanding of our attention?
I think the issues of peace and human interaction are reflected in my own interest in religious history and in terms of fundamentalism. I think that what we are now dealing with in the United States is a globalized culture where if we do not understand Islam, we are not just missing the point about what's going on in the Middle East. We're missing the point about what's going on in Southeast Asia. We're missing the point of what's going on in Africa. And we are missing the point of what's going on in Philadelphia, Los Angeles, and Chicago.
Now, again, to turn to some sort of scholarly terminology, mm-hmm. what you're getting at here is the difference between what we call essentialism on the one hand, that is to say that human nature is the same all over the globe and throughout time, and on the other hand, that the 50-cent term is alterity, that there are peoples who are just utterly, completely different from us and will never really come to terms with them. How about it?
Okay, particularity is the term that I like to use. Particularity and universal qualities of humanity mm-hmm. are simply two different levels of generalization. That there are levels that even though I have lived with my children all their lives, I still don't understand them. That means that they have particularity.
Right.
And yet, at the same time, I feel that my wife, my two children, and I represent a broader unit. What we need to be able to do is to transfer that kind of tolerance of particularity and communal unity to the larger levels of society, civilization, and the globe.
John, what is the responsibility of the scholar in the modern, again, in this picture of geopolitics that we face? We have the politicians who make the decisions. We have their advisors, many of whom come from the academic world. And then we have people such as you and your colleagues in the Middle Eastern Studies Association who sort of talk around the topics. Do you feel that you have a particular responsibility or a way into the solutions to these problems?
I think that the contribution to solution that scholars make is in the development of knowledge as well as the preservation of knowledge. That too often scholars get so wrapped up in simply passing on knowledge that they become part of the problem.
And how do they move beyond that?
They move beyond that by being engaged with the society that they find themselves. The ivory tower intellectual may have a purpose if she or he is doing nuclear physics, mm-hmm. or is doing linguistics, or is doing literary translation. But even that must, in fact, provide some way of having the scholar be engaged in the society around. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm finding now is that in America, awareness of Islam is much greater. Sometimes it's misguided, but it's much greater than it was when I started teaching more than 30 years ago. People now, thanks to the Ayatollah Khomeini, most people know that there's more than one kind of Islam, the Shiite Islam and Sunni Islam. Mm-hmm. 1965, most people that I met didn't know that. I think a second thing is that in addition to this increasing awareness, because of the interaction of populations and societies and cultures, we now have a significant Islamic population in the United States. And that significant population provides a basis for interaction. Now, sometimes it poses problems, as with the bombing of the Trade Center and the people in New Jersey.
I was just going to say, it also sets up a target.
It also sets up a target. But what you've got, I think it's better, in fact, to have somebody that you know that you are in a battle with than it is to have somebody that you simply think of is like a man from Mars that you don't have to interact with.
Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily make fighting the battle any easier, does it?
Doesn't make fighting the battle any easier, but I think it gives some greater hope that the battle can be won.
Mm-hmm.
The battle of understanding can be won.
We're talking after a fashion about what we would call holism rather than particularism.
Well, we're talking about asking the question, what is the operating unit that is most effective to look at? If you are talking about the market for McDonald's hamburgers, you're not talking particularism versus holism. You're saying, what is it that it makes the most effective analytical unit? If you're talking about trying to understand, for example, the role of Muslims in the world, the Middle East no longer is an effective operating unit in terms of the boundaries that were drawn by the specialists in the 1940s and 1950s.
Well, if the challenges to the scholars, as I understand you, John, are if they were daunting 30 or 40 years ago, they are absolutely catastrophic in their implications today.
That's right. And what it means now is not only do you have to overcome the boundaries between history and political science and linguistics, now what you have to do is overcome the boundaries between the specialist in Soviet affairs, the specialist in Indonesian affairs, and the specialist in Middle East.
Well, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation on that note, John Vall. And let me ask you to, again, we're trying to unpack some difficult issues here. Are you fundamentally optimistic about the relationships between the United States and the countries of the Middle East? As you look, you know, from the standpoint of diplomatic history and political history, and as an informed citizen?
I am optimistic that at least there's the possibility of having relationships that can be productive. I do not think that it's fruitful to hope that all of the countries in the world are going to live in love and peace. I do not think that it's fruitful to insist that to have good relations, the countries have to be friends. All they have to do is to be able to think in terms of cooperating on issues of common interest. Now, the difficulty is that in the modern globe, there's almost no interest that isn't common with a whole bunch of other people.
So you are and yet are not optimistic at the same time. That's a good scholarly answer.
You've got it. Very, very much right in the middle.
John Vaal, I want to thank you for coming by the National Humanities Center. You have just finished a term as president of the Middle Eastern Studies Association. You're a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire, and I want to mention one of your books here is called Islam, Continuity and Change in the Modern World. We can look for a new edition from Syracuse University Press in the fall of 1994. John Vaal, thank you for coming by to talk on Soundings. I wish you well in your work.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like to have an audio cassette of this week's show. You've been listening to a conversation with John Vaal, professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and president of the Middle East Studies Association of North America. For an audio cassette of this discussion, send $10 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 707. That's number 707. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Next week, part 5 of New Southerners, a continuing series of programs on the work of contemporary Southern writers. Novelist Jill McCorkle will be here to read from and talk about her books, including her novel July 7th and her most recent book, a collection of stories entitled Crash Diet. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.